Memory has a way of playing tricks on you. Something you could swear happened one way might be remembered completely differently by someone else who was there. And every time we revisit our memories, we update them with the conditions of the present moment. Over time, memories fade until they become like distant lights seen from across a river. You can paddle and paddle, but you never quite reach the light. And yet, our stories are what define us. The truth isn't necessarily in the details. It's in the impulse to keep telling ourselves who we are and where we've been. Looking back, it's tempting to try to make sense out of it all, to consider that what happened happened for a reason or fit neatly within some kind of logical order. But maybe you've heard about the butterfly effect. It's a concept from chaos theory that describes how small changes in a system can lead to vastly different outcomes. If you want to be poetic about it, you might say something like, a butterfly flapping its wings in Brazil could set off a tornado in Texas. And while that's not how it literally works, it does seem that only with the benefit of time are we really able to make sense out of what happened and recognize that small little variations in our lives can have significant effects. Today, I'm revisiting a single event in my own life that has had lasting consequences. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. 20 years ago this week, my then-girlfriend Amanda and I loaded up a Penske truck in Wisconsin, and we drove to New York City. We had no idea what we were hoping for. At the time, I thought we'd stay a year or two, just a little adventure. 2 decades later, Amanda is no longer my girlfriend. She's my wife and the mother of our 14-year-old daughter, who's a full-blown Brooklyn kid. And Amanda is also here with me today.
Hi, everybody.
Amanda, the last time you were on the podcast was over a year ago when we were celebrating the 10th anniversary of The Third Story. Today, we're marking another milestone. It's the 20th anniversary of our move to New York. It's a move that came on the heels of the Oscar win for the song Al Otro Lado del Rio. I never know if I should say it with the American accent, Al Otro Lado del Rio, or the Spanish one.
Tomato, tomato.
Either way, that's been 20 years too. And the song means a lot to us personally, but it also carries a lot of historical weight. It was the first Spanish language song ever to be nominated in that Oscar category, and only the second non-English song, I think, of any kind to win. And if you fast forward to this year's Oscars, El Mal from Emilia Perez won the same category, and nobody blinked. But in 2005, Al Otro Lado del Rio getting nominated was a big deal. It was a song that was written by our friend Jorge Drexler, who's from Uruguay, a small country in South America. But at the time, he had been living in Spain for about a decade already. He wasn't super famous. He was like a songwriter's songwriter, very respected, but under the radar. So when he won, it was a shock to the Hollywood system. And for Uruguay, it was just a huge cultural moment. All these years later, Jorge, I think, would probably reject the idea of being called a national hero. But he is one, and it all goes back to that night. It's also remembered as one of the more unusual Oscar moments because he wasn't allowed to perform his own song. He wasn't considered famous enough. So when he got up to accept the award, he just sang a few lines of the song a cappella. It felt like this quiet but powerful act of defiance. And here's another piece of the story. You know this. Jorge also wrote the song while he was visiting Madison, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. We recorded it there, and I co-produced it. And somehow that song, written in a borrowed house in the Midwest, led to you and me, Amanda, having this surreal fairy tale night at the Oscars.
Very surreal.
But before we get to that night, I want to go even further back in your memory to the summer of 2003. That was the beginning of us. Everything was new. And that was also the summer I worked on the song Al Otro Lado del Rio for the movie The Motorcycle Diaries. It was a film about a road trip taken by a young Che Guevara. And it was directed by the Brazilian filmmaker Walter Salles, whose film I'm Still Here actually won an Oscar this year. Okay, so Amanda, what do you remember about that summer in Madison?
I remember that Jorge Drexler and his partner at the time, Analan, were in Madison. We were still pretty new, you and I. So I knew of them. I met them. There were gigs that you played. I think I had them for dinner at my apartment on the rooftop. And yes, I remember at some point that Jorge got the call to write this song, and he happened to be in Madison with his partner and son for the summer. And so he ended up writing the song and recruiting you to help and some of your musician friends. And it was written and recorded in Madison. I mean, that was you had met a few years prior. Your families had formed a relationship. I think he respected the work that you did. You were a huge admirer of him. And I think you felt very hashtag blessed to have had the opportunity to meet him and start this relationship. And as far as I remember, this was your first actual sort of collaboration with him. First of many.
I actually called my dad earlier today to fill in that picture a little bit more completely and to tell me what he remembered about our early friendship with Jorge and how Jorge and Ana and their son Pablo, who lived outside of Madrid in a little town called El Escorial, had come to spend their summers in Madison, Wisconsin with us.
What I first remember about Jorge was when you were in Seville, you were living in this kind of dark, cold water flat, supposedly going to college, and I came to visit you. There was like a bulb hanging from a cord from the ceiling. And the one thing you wanted to show me or share with me was this CD that you had found of somebody named Jorge Drexler. Nobody knew Jorge Drexler at the time. I don't know how you discovered this CD, but you were holding on to it like a log in the flood. You weren't going to school. You had trouble getting out of bed, but you were somehow attached to this CD. I heard it, and it was beautiful. And I remember saying to you, you know what? If what you're working on is getting out of bed, that's a good thing to work on. And Jorge was clearly one of the things that got you out of bed. I guess it was a year later or something. We met Jorge. We were playing this gig in a little city outside of Madrid. We didn't know he was there at the gig, but the next day we were at this club, the Café Central in Madrid, and sitting at the bar, you recognized him, was Jorge, and you went and talked to him, and the next thing, we became friends, and our families got together. Jorge and his son Pablo was just a little kid, I don't know, 5 or 6 at the time, and Ana, Lan, Judy, and you and I, and we became kind of a little blended family in Madrid. It was very natural, and I think that's kind of remained the core of our relationship. So when eventually it turned into something much larger, I'm sure we all saw it and felt like it was just a natural outgrowth of us hanging out and coming together.
What do you remember about the Al Otro Lado del Rio experience? What's your memory of when you first became aware of the song and all that?
Well, the first thing I remember, Jorge and I at the time were riding bikes every day through this arboretum. And he mentioned that he had gotten a phone call for a commission to write some music for a film. And it didn't seem to loom particularly large. It was just a gig, and we talked about it as just part of a conversation. And then a couple days later, he told me he had written the song, but he didn't seem to be particularly obsessed or anything about it. It was just a commission.
A big part of the preface to this is that he and you and I and Jeff Eccles had been playing gigs in a little club in Madison for a few summers in a row and exploring what it would mean to treat his material with a slightly more jazz aesthetic, a little freer, to kind of break some of the rules that maybe he was accustomed to playing by.
Yeah, and there's some pretty good tape of us playing together at that gig we had at the Big Top Chautauqua. These gigs that we played, I mean, I loved them. I loved playing Jorge's music. But I think it was a new experience for Jorge to surrender some control. It kind of loosened him up a little bit. No queríamos dormir, nos queríamos comer el mundo. No podíamos dejar de estar a solas ni un segundo. Ida y vuelta de la cama a la alfombra voladora. Nos bastaba con dejar pasar las horas. And the experience of doing this with family, our family and their family, I think was very powerful for all of us. I mean, Ana wrote a song about Madison. Pablo, last time we saw him, said he wanted to come back to Madison. And of course, Jorge took away an Academy Award from it.
Well, yeah. And when I talked to Jorge about it, he basically confirmed everything you just said.
We became friends, you and I and your family, your father, your mother, and my family at that moment, Ana and Pablo. We became friends a few years before that, at the beginning of the millennium. We started going to Madison, Wisconsin to spend our 1 month every vacation. And our son would go to a camp. And that's where he finished learning his English. And I was enjoyed being there so much. And I was staying at a common friend's house that lent us the house across your family's house, yep. Across the street.
Was it the Sweets house?
We were at the Sweets house. I didn't know if I wanted, but I'm sure they would be happy to tell that I was staying at the Sweets house, a family of friends in common that we had. And I wrote almost my whole record Echo there, which was a very, very important record for me, which it was like 1 year before the Oscars. And that was the real point of inflection of my career. No, the Oscars just came in the right moment and just gave it a push. But I had already changed the way of writing and changed the way I saw my songs and changed the way I related with my audience and with spreading of my music.
Yes. And I'll just take a moment to say the Sweets, Kelly Conway is a film professor specializing in French film, and the house was filled with DVDs of French film, if I remember. And that was something that was important to your thinking when you were writing.
There are many songs that were influenced by Kelly's collection of French films. I have a song called Deseo. Deseo, mire donde mire te veo. Mire donde mire te veo. Mire donde mire te veo. I have another song that I wrote 5 years later that talks about a film of Eric Rohmer, the French movie director. Amar la trama más que el desenlace por ahí como en un film de Eric Rohmer sin esperar que algo pase. I think I was really inspired those days. I wrote the record Echo, which 20 years later, I still think it's composition-wise, it's my densest record. Every song I wrote there, I kept it on my repertoire. So, and half of the songs of that record, I wrote them in 1 week in Madison, that week.
Yes, wow.
So and that I would write a song a day, Echo one day. Echo. Transporte one day. ¿Dónde tú estás? Yo tengo el norte y no hay nada como tu amor como medio de transporte. Se va, se fue another day. Se va, se va, se fue. Polvo de estrellas another day. No dejaremos huella, solo polvo de estrellas. Films that I saw at that house, so it kept influencing me for many years what happened at that house that summer. It might also have been inside Al Otro Lado del Río because I didn't get to see the film. I wrote it with a script. I was staying at their house and Walter Salles sent me the script, and it was a very big production. There was a lot of secrecy around it, so they didn't want to send me the film. Mm. So I got the script, I read it before I went to sleep. I read it once, and I went to sleep, and I woke up like at 5 or 6 in the morning, really early, and I dreamt these verses. I dreamt, creo que he visto una luz al otro lado del río. Remembering, I think I saw a light at the other side of the river. I remember from the whole script, it really caught my attention, that sequence, when Ernesto Guevara crosses the river to the other side. Well, at the other side, there was a leprosario. How do you call that?
A leper colony.
A leper colony. So it was a very symbolic river crossing. It was dangerous. It was in the night. And it went from the side of the privileged to the side of the unprivileged.
Yeah.
So I saw that metaphor. And that was the metaphor that I liked. I was once a medicine student myself, and I traveled myself South America. So you could see how it would impact a young medical student getting in touch with the reality of the poverty in South America and taking the decision to go there and to cross to the other side of the problem, the other side of the river. So I woke up saying, creo que he visto una luz al otro lado del río, which are 2 8-syllable verses in Spanish, octosyllabos. I don't want to get too technical, but I have a TED talk about it.
Yes.
So you can go, it's called Identity and Poetry, something like that. And you can find it in the TED talks about that kind of form of poetry form. So, creo que viste una luz al otro lado del río. And I woke up and I wrote the whole song backwards. Mm. You know, that's something that I never talked about it with Leonard Cohen, but I'm sure he did too. There's many songs where he goes around in a long round verse until he comes to the last chorus, 1,000 Kisses Deep. for example, no? And you know that you will have to rhyme with ip, no?
Yes.
And so you go back and you write backwards.
The ponies run, the girls are young, the odds are there to be. You win a while, and then it's done, your little winning streak. And summer now to deal with your invincible defeat. You live your life as if it's real. A thousand kisses deep.
And that's what I did. I said, creo que he visto una luz al otro lado del río. Clavo mi remo en el agua, llevo tu remo en el mío. Creo que he visto una luz al otro lado del río. So you go back, I put my row on the water. I'm carrying your row in mine.
Yes.
So we're rowing together.
Your
oar. Oar, see? I think I saw a light on the other side of the river. And you have a version, better version than the one I'm giving in English of that song, you know.
Yes, it's true. Years later, I did my own adaptation of the song in English, and we called it Row On. And I translated those lyrics as closely and as poetically as I could.
I dip my blade in the water and hold on to both of our oars. I think that I see a light just on the other shore.
That was the way I wrote the song. Then I said it needs a chorus. Mm-hmm. And I said, sobre todo creo que no todo está perdido. And above all, I think not everything is lost, which was a very hopeful phrase. And I found many years later that it's never a bad moment to be hopeful.
Yes.
This particular moment is a really good moment.
Every moment you think it cannot get worse, it's possible that it can get worse, and we need hope.
And it will get worse, and you will need that phrase. And
yes.
I didn't know how bad things would get.
Yes.
But they keep getting worse.
Yeah.
And,
yes.
You know, they get better, too, in other things. You know, you see lots of good things happening in the last generations related to human rights and to diversity and to everything. And you know, to the rights of a big part of the world population that wasn't there. But also there's bad things happening and you need to have something to hold on. And so that process started, like I told you, like at 6 o'clock in the morning. And by 10, I would have the finished song. I had asked you for a AKG 414 microphone.
Yes.
You remember
yes.
that?
Of course.
It was recorded really in one take. I made a little loop with a guitar, that you would hear at the beginning of the song.
Yeah.
And I made maybe one take of guitar and maybe one take of voice and of the vocals with a microphone you lent me.
Clavo mi remo en el agua, llevo tu remo en el mío. Creo que he visto una luz al otro lado del río.
By 10 or 11, when I started thinking that it was late enough in LA to wake up somebody, and I was very thrilled, and I had this feeling that the song was good. So I was really eager to show it to Walter Sales. Walter had asked me to write a song to the famous goddess of singing in South America, Mercedes Sosa. And I was really eager to send it to Walter so he would send it to Mercedes Sosa in Argentina.
Because the idea was she would sing the song.
She would sing the song. I wasn't supposed to sing the song. She was supposed to sing the song. So I sent it to Walter. And of course, you know, a director in the last days of his
production,
he was awake at 4 o'clock in the morning in LA or something like that. And I very quickly got a message from him saying, I love it. It's already in the film.
Yeah.
And I said, wait, you have to send it to Mercedes.
Yeah.
And she has to sing it. How are you going to do that? And he said, you know what? We placed it the way it is in the film.
Yeah.
And everybody was really moved in the room. And I think it's going to go with your voice. And I said, no, please, it's a first take. Just let me hear it again. I'm not sure if it's in, I don't know. The lyrics are right. I heard it. It was okay. There wasn't big mistakes. The only thing I And it took me a couple of days to convince him to tell him, let me go to a studio and try to make a new take and make some arrangements. So, you know, so it has a little bit more, you know, a narrative. Let's put a narrative to it. So that's when I talked to you and I asked you to direct the production in Madison. So we went to Butch Vig's.
Butch Vig's studio, Smart Studios, yeah.
You did some beautiful arrangements and we made some strings arrangements. And we had Ben playing the piano and the double bass was played by
Jeff Eccles,
magnificent work. And Anna Lang recorded some backing vocals and you recorded the drums and the arrangements were really nice. And I think we did the right thing going there and taking our time, but we couldn't get a better voice take.
Sobre todo creo que no todo está perdido. Tanta lágrima y yo soy un vaso vacío. Oigo una voz que me llama, casi un suspiro.
And I think it's the original guitar also.
And it's the original guitar also. There's something about the moment, and I'm sure your father Ben will agree with me. We talked about this many, many times. There's something about the emotion of the first love that you have with the song, and it's and it's unbeatable.
Oh yeah, my dad absolutely agrees with that.
Well, I'm a great believer in the first take and the magic that happens in the first take when you do something that's even a surprise to yourself. When you don't know what you're doing, you have the opportunity to rise to the occasion without being self-conscious. And there's a thing about recording where small and intimate plays very large. It captures the space around the music as well as the music. And that song is a great example of that. I mean, if you had come in the door with a 30-piece orchestra and a huge arrangement, the ultimate experience would sound smaller. It would sound compressed. But the fact that it's an acoustic guitar and a voice in a very intimate space captured the heart and soul of the song. It's a very intimate sounding piece of music.
I'm lucky enough that I recorded it in one take, but I was careful to make a nice one take because I wanted to convince Walter Salles that the song was good. But it was really moving, and I tried to do it better, and I just couldn't. And so we surrendered, and we put the beautiful arrangement that you can hear now, but the loop, the guitar track and the voice track are the originals that I recorded with your 414 that you lent me.
Yes. So two comments. First of all, this 414.
You still have it?
Of course, I can never sell it. I mean, it's a historic microphone, and so I'm looking at it as I speak to you.
You can sell it to me if you want.
The only person who can buy this microphone is you. That's true. But also, you know, it's funny because my father is listed as playing piano on it, but he's not on the track in the end.
It was you.
Well, this is a controversy. If you look at the credits, you'll see, yes, I am playing piano on it. And in fact, if you go to Spotify, it's my number one song as a performer. So I guess in terms of history, yes, I'm playing on it. But in truth, no, I'm not playing on it. It's a good story. The producer of the film had a very limited budget for the music. And at one point, you and Jorge wanted to do some sweetening of the track and needed another $1,000. It wasn't a lot of money. And the producer had heard of me, had heard the name Ben Sidran. And so you used that as a way to have him get up off of some of the money by saying, well, I can get Ben Sidran to play piano on this. So we got the extra money. You got the extra money. And I believe I came in the studio and what I played was useless. It was the best gig I never had. And so you wound up playing it, but of course you had to put my name on it. So the answer to your question is, yes, I'm playing on it, and no, I'm not playing on it.
I mean, I don't know if you remember this. I have a memory of trying to get more money from the production company to mix it at Smart or to finish it properly or to get a little more recording budget.
I'm sure it happened because it always happens.
It always happens.
I'm sure, yeah.
you know, there were two things that we managed to do. This is my memory, to get money from them. One was we promised them that we could get the great jazz legend Ben Sidran to play on the song, which is why he's credited on the song, even though we didn't use what he played.
Well, he definitely influenced in the existence of the song.
Absolutely.
By getting us together and by bringing us to Madison. And he was in spirit all
over
course. The song.
Of course. He provided even genetic material for the song. Yeah. So he did a lot of work. But I also remember, and I learned a lot by watching this happen, I was on the phone with the producer trying to explain why we needed, I mean, it was a very small budget. Maybe we wanted another $1,000 or something from them. You know, I was young and I was nervous and I was trying to find a way to convince him that we needed money. And at one point you said to me, can I speak to him for a second? And you got on the phone and you started to speak in very artistic terms to him. You know, you said, look, this is a song about crossing a river and there needs to be the narrative, very much like what you told Walter Salles, you know. And it's very important that you feel this opening. And anyway, the guy finally said, fine, okay, you can have the money.
I don't remember that, but it sounds like me.
And what I learned was I had been trying to be a professional producer and explain in rational terms why we needed this money. And you spoke to him like an artist and he could respect that. I mean, that was my takeaway from it.
Poetry always beats every other argument. In my experience, poetry moves people. If you're writing a song to move people that listen to it and you have to convince somebody in the team that has to put more money, moving him is a very good strategy too. And it's a very human strategy and a very gentle one, a very, very nice. And it's considerate. I mean, because you start by considering the person that's at the other side of the line or at the other side of the river in the telephone. You consider him a sensitive human being. So you say, you can understand that. You can understand that this is about poetry and you're going to understand this and you're going to give us $1,000.
And you're going to give us $1,000. It's lovely to hear you talk about how moved you were by the song and how you felt that it was a good song, because I always had a feeling that it was not one of your most important songs. I mean, I felt extremely proud to have worked on it. And I've looked at the video of there's a little documentary footage of us mixing it at Smart Studios. And I can see how seriously we took it. And you were as committed to it as any other thing that you had ever done. But I don't know that I understood that it was such an important song. And anyway, it sort of went off into the world and we didn't really know much about its fate for quite a while.
I completely forgot about it.
You know, Jorge, I didn't tell you this before, but I actually talked to Ana Lan also about her memory of this time. And she said the same thing.
The funny thing is kind of looking back and seeing what happened afterwards, we didn't give it that much importance. It was kind of like, oh, you know, a commission that came up. He really liked Walter. They had a good relationship. He would never say no to anything because he loves writing so much. And we did it, but it never crossed my mind that it would have this tremendous repercussions.
Yeah, that's I'm glad to hear you say that, because that's kind of my sense of it also. And in fact, you know, really, I think the reason it got made in Madison the way it did is because it was a commission that came very quickly and it didn't have a lot of resources. There wasn't even enough money, I don't think, for him to go anywhere else to do it.
No. It was like, oh, I remember being, I think I was probably miffed because it was our vacation or something like that initially. I think there must have been something of that, like, oh no, you're going to work?
Yeah.
And then just kind of, okay, let's do it. And nothing extraordinary about it. I listened to it last night, actually, because I wanted to sort of remember. It's such a beautiful song.
You know, when it was nominated and then won, there was always a part of me that thought, he's written such incredible things, and I didn't consider this to be among them. And I will say, I have grown to appreciate it more than I did at the time, and appreciate what's going on and how beautiful it is.
I get that totally, because I kind of had the same feeling, like it was never like central to the film. It's not in the background in any scene or anything. It's on the credits. And I also kind of had that feeling like this is one of Jorge's more sort of minor songs. But listening to it last night, it's just really beautiful.
I actually don't have any memory of the movie itself coming out or whatever the response to it was. Do you remember before it was nominated, do you remember having thought about the song very much after that?
Not in the least. I don't think the movie came out here in Spain before the Oscars. No, it just kind of faded into the background.
But, you know, Jorge says that he did know there was something special about it.
I'll tell you, I knew it was important. Let's say it in a modest way, no? Because it was important for me. And I understand that it wasn't easy to perceive from your side of the street, mm-hmm. which was across the street, actually. You know?
Yes.
Because you knew my songs. You knew my songs. We played together for many years at that point, and you knew my repertoire, and I knew yours. But there's something deeply rooted in folk music, because the key to what I thought about the song is that it was written to Mercedes Sosa.
Mm-hmm.
It's a baguala, you know.
Yep.
You know, it's like a... It's out of field. But it's a boom, boom, back, boom, boom. I took the most folkloric side of me to write that song. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I used the harmonic world that I'm used to putting in my songs, which is more related to, you know, to jazz or to bossa nova. So I realized that the song had this power of putting together different worlds. It was crossing its own aesthetic rivers, mm-hmm. you know, going from one side to the other and mixing folk music with a very contemporary language. And believe it or not, it was a sign of the times at that moment. And at some point, I think it had to do with the impression it produced in the people that heard it. There was something in the Spanish-speaking artistic world that was coming into sophistication without losing its root. When I wrote it, I said, I think I did a good song,
a good song.
For these times. And I think I nailed it for the movie. I didn't know it. Of course, I didn't know it, what was going to happen. But I said, I understood Walter Salles, although I was very sad at the beginning when he didn't call Mercedes Sosa. I was so looking forward to having a song of mine sung by her, which it happened later in another couple of songs. But I understand that he wanted like a contemporary voice on it. A voice that took it out of the root of direct folk, traditional folk, Latin American music. And also, the way we produced it and that you arranged it, it had something to do with the place that we were in Madison, the moment that we were in, the environment that we were in with a jazz musician's environment. So I think it make it understandable to North American ears and at the same time to South American ears. That's why I thought it was an important song.
You know, for many years, I have been asking myself this question. It's very possible if you had just put the demo in the record, it would have won. And it's very possible that if you had gone to work with your team that you were working with at the time regularly in South America, and they had done something that played more with the tropes of folklore, it would have won. We don't know that. What we do know is that this strange collaboration that brought, you know, a Uruguayan singer-songwriter to Wisconsin to make a song for a film by a Brazilian director is the thing that won.
Yeah.
It never occurred to me that it won in part because of the conditions in which it was recorded. I always thought at the time, oh, these conditions are... You're dealing with them because it's where you find yourself, and you had to do it with us in Madison. But I love thinking part of the way that it communicated, especially to the Academy, because ultimately the song had to be voted by a largely American committee. Maybe it was helpful that it had a little bit of that non-folklore sensibility in the way it was produced.
First of all, I want to tell you that I do think it had to do with it. And I do believe that we did everything in the most unconscious way.
Yes.
I didn't think of that at the moment, but I was involved in jazz music,
yes.
in playing with you and your father and with Jeff. And so it was really natural to say, I always try to work with the elements I have around me at that moment and at that time. So it was the natural thing for me to say, oh, no, let's not search in Chicago for a guy that plays the bombo leguero and a guy that plays, you know, Latin percussion and maybe a traditional guitarist. I'm sure that there are some,
yes.
Because it's a big city. But so let's do it with what we have here.
Yeah.
But at the other time, I want to say, I think part of the effect the song produced, it was obviously related to the great success that Spanish language was starting to have in the United States, and it just kept growing, you know? So I always saw that people at the academy, North American, English-speaking, basically, mainly, artists, too, and people of the art, of the cultural industry, found a way to show their appreciation to what the Spanish language was opening in the United States, their appreciation to the movie, which also held some political controversy because it was a film about Che Guevara. So it didn't get one of the main nominations. It got only Best Song and Best Adapted Screenplay. But they wanted to show that appreciation. And the fact of the song being introduced, wrapped with a language that they could relate to, I think it had to do too. So they could feel at home while relating to, you know, this foreign, acute politically song that also spoke very metaphorically. And people, you know, although they don't understand everything in the lyrics, they understand what it that it's not a slogan.
Yeah.
And it's not
Or an anthem. It's not made as an anthem.
It's not an anthem. Although at some point... It became a little bit of that. But it wasn't meant to be. It was meant, you know, a really heartfelt song. But I think it really worked for the movie. And it actually did. It actually worked for the movie. Yeah. And this was 2003 when we recorded it. 2003.
Yes, 2003.
Yes, 2003. It came out in 2004. And just remember what we were listening to those days. We were listening to 69 love songs. Yes. And
you know, I interviewed him yesterday. I just interviewed Stephen Merritt.
That's amazing. Yeah. So we were listening to music that would mix, you know, acoustics music with string guitar and with soft voices, you know. So I think it was, we were playing in the era too.
Okay, so let's now tell the other part of the story, because you forgot about it, as we sort of all did. You know, it was made in 2003. The movie came out in 2004. How did it end up getting submitted?
I don't think the production company paid a lot of attention to that song that appeared, if you remember, it appeared at the very end of the end, when the lights of the cinema were on already, which it ended being a good thing, because I think at that moment you're between reality and dream. Mm. So it's a good moment to hear a song that's moving. So, you know, it had a magnificent score by Gustavo Santaolalla, and everybody thought that the score was going to be
nominated.
We were all thinking about that. And someday I would just call Focus Feature for something else. And the girl that answered the phone said, by the way, Jorge, I have to tell you this. You know, the Oscars are coming and your song can be part of a Best Original Song category nominee. You have to send it yourself. So she sent me the address and I just filled up Wilshire Boulevard, 37, I don't know how much, the Academy of Awards. And I put the form in an envelope and I sent it urgent, because she said, you have 1 week to do it. It's ending next week, so you better do it now. Nobody did it for me. Yeah. So I ended up doing it myself. And I sent that letter and I completely forgot about it. I don't know when I sent it. I think maybe October 2004 or something like that. And I completely forgot about that. I was completely sure that the Oscars had already happened.
Yeah.
I didn't pay much attention about that. And I got this phone call from a radio in Barcelona saying, we want to interview you. I was driving the car for your Oscar nomination. And I said, come on. And I hung up. And I said, who is this? You know, I hung up. And the moment I hung up the phone, I had in 30 seconds, something like 25 lost phone calls. So I pulled out the car of the road and I answered the next phone call, and it was from another radio from Argentina saying, you have been nominated to the Oscars 2 minutes ago. I said, but didn't the Oscars already happen for that movie? I mean, I'm always really unaware of the dates. And that was it. It was actually nominee.
I talked to Anna about the day it was nominated and also how you then prepared to go to the Oscars. I mean, you were living in El Escorial. It was like traveling to another planet.
I was on the train. We were living, you know, outside of Madrid. And I was on the train on my way down to Madrid, it was in the morning, and I got an ecstatic call from him saying he'd been nominated for an Oscar. And I think it was January. I remember it was cold outside. There was snow on the ground. And I was just completely flabbergasted. I don't know. It was so out of my experience to that time, you know, to that moment, that I was just really, really amazed.
So you made these plans to come to LA for the Oscars. What did you do with Pablo?
Oh, well, I mean, the whole thing was insane because there were all these things to decode, like what the hell is black tie and stuff like that. And I had there was a woman who helped me in the house and stuff.
Yeah.
So we actually paid them to stay and look after Pablo. And I actually think that was really hard for him, because I do remember afterwards, I remember being with him on a beach in Uruguay and him asking me, how do you write stupid mommy on the beach?
Oh, God.
He was very angry at us for having left him behind. Yeah. Rightly so.
Right. Yeah. So you did the decoding, and, you know, and one of the wonderful gestures, and when I think about it, it speaks to the nature of the relationship between our families, that I was invited to come out and hang out with you during that week in LA, and Amanda was invited, because, I mean, it's not necessarily standard to invite the co-producer of the song to the Oscars.
That was love. I have a really, really good memories of that. I think we were there for, what was it, a week, 10 days? And I just remember it being so interesting and so fun.
Part of that, I think, was this sense of really being outsiders who had been invited into like a club or like a private space that normally we just would never get to see.
Exactly.
Okay, Amanda, I think this is the part of the story that you do remember well. Once the song was nominated, Jorge and Ana invited us to go to LA for the week leading up to the Oscars and spend it with them.
Yes.
And we did spend most of the week with them, and we went with them to all kinds of places. But the one place we couldn't go was to the actual Oscars ceremony, because I was not entitled to
have a ticket.
Right, only
the songwriter gets invited to the show and gets the nomination.
And the award.
Yeah.
But basically, they said, come for as long as you can. We'll take you with us
everywhere
else.
Yeah. They said anywhere we can get you in, we'll get you in.
Right. Okay, so at the time, we're living in Madison. We're in our late 20s. You're a project manager at a graphic design studio and a waitress. I'm a musician playing local gigs. We have to figure out even what we're going to wear.
Yeah.
We don't even know where we're going to wear this stuff, but we got to have stuff to wear.
Yeah.
You took me to Marshall Field's, and I bought a black with white pinstripe suit. You were completely screwed. Like, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
If the stars align and you happen to find yourself among the Hollywood elite, what is this waitress project manager from Madison going to be wearing at these events?
It was a disaster. I mean, I thought I did pretty good at the time, but looking back on it with what I know now, it was pretty much a disaster.
What did you choose to do for your big event piece?
For the big show, I bought a I bought a dress at the gift shop at the hotel in Mexico where we had stayed. And I thought it was pretty fabulous at the time. And I just thought, well, if I can't get couture, I'm just going to go off the rails.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. And the rest of it, I sort of cobbled together between like the best you could do in Madison, Scotchy, which doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
Karen and Company across the street from Scotchy, which doesn't exist anymore.
But this is all basically university area. This is university shopping.
This is like the best you can do in Madison.
Yeah.
Marshall Field's. I bought a few different pairs of high heels, strappy sandals.
So you remember this?
I hadn't thought about it, but now looking back, like I can remember three outfits that I wore, one being the night of the Oscars, one being the night of, we went to a CAA party, and then the other one was this composer's party that we went to that was like an afternoon tea at something or something at somebody's house, and I remember what I wore to that.
What did you wear to that one?
I wore like a knee-length embroidered skirt and, you know, slingback heels, and then I remember at the CAA party, I wore this silk sort of tunic and some high, you know, strappy stilettos. It's coming back to me now. It's very funny when I think about it. I thought I was pulling it off, you know, the best that I could.
Well, we were really dropped into the jungle.
It was crazy.
That week leading up to it,
yeah,
we went to all these parties. Like you say, composers. I mean, it was John Williams, I remember.
Yeah.
And
I mean, the composers, but I don't really remember. But the CAA party, it was like Clive Owen and Adrian Brody. And imagine being at a Hollywood party And that's what it was like. 95% of the people in there were recognizable celebrity faces. Oh, and there was another night. We went to some Latin awards.
Latin awards.
Yeah, also.
Exactly. Yeah. Because we were traveling basically in the world of Latin Hollywood.
Right.
So it was like Maria Full of Grace that year was the other big one.
Right.
We did have a lot of access. I mean, we went everywhere with Jorge and Ana.
Yes.
I took meetings when we weren't with them. I ran around the city to meet with other people.
Yes.
To try to schmooze and see what it could. Yeah. And it was very interesting. I mean, here I was, the co-producer of this Oscar-nominated song, so I could get into any room I wanted to get into. But I was clearly on the outside. I had no idea how the business worked. I was trying to figure out, like, what do I even do with this nomination?
Right. Who are the people you talk to? What are the questions you ask? What are you trying to...
What am I trying to get?
Yeah.
What is the thing that I might try to do with this?
Right.
And do I have to move to LA? Do I have to move to... We started to talk about leaving Madison at that time. So now the night of the Academy Awards, we didn't have tickets to the actual event. We were staying with our friends. They had, at the time, they had twin teenage girls.
Yep.
They were probably Sol's age. They were probably our daughter's age.
I think they were maybe 15, maybe. A little older than Sol, but yes.
They thought we were just the coolest.
They did. Yeah. Shockingly, they did.
We end up doing, I guess, Chinese takeout with them.
Yep. Sitting in the basement in like the rec room watching the show. Eating Chinese takeout, but we also had a dinner plan to go out with your friend Mike Rock.
From Comedy Sports.
From Comedy Sports after that, because we just didn't think in a million years, we thought we'd watch that he wouldn't win. We'd go out to dinner with our friend, and we were leaving the next day to drive to Palm Springs and see your poppy.
See my grandfather before we flew back to Madison.
Right. So we're at home, at our friend's house, eating Chinese takeout.
And you remember it was Prince who gave out the Best Original Song Award that year.
Now that you've heard all the nominated songs, it's time to announce who will receive the Oscar for Original Song.
When Prince came out on stage, I was completely convinced that I wasn't going to win, completely convinced, until a short conversation I had with you. But so when Prince came out, I said, oh, what a pity, it would have been great. Just to meet Prince, you know, it would have been great to win, to shake his hand. And when he said my name, that's the first thing I thought. I say, I'm going to shake Prince's hand. No?
Jorge Drexler for our Ultra Lucky Del Rio from the Motorcycle Diary.
And I'm going to sing because I don't want to give a speech. And there was this polemica, how to say polemica?
Controversy, yeah.
Controversy. I wasn't invited to sing the song. And there was this controversy between the Latin film industry and the production of the show.
Let's put it this way. Jorge was not comfortable with having someone else perform his song.
Mm-hmm.
And he pushed pretty hard to have it sung by himself. But of course, he had no clout whatsoever. I remember that year, Beyoncé was doing a song.
She sang every other song at the awards.
My God. And I remember the guy who ran the Oscars at the time, I can't remember his name.
Gil Cates.
Gil Cates saying to Jorge, I have a hot celebrity singing, you know, and nobody knows who you are. And I remember feeling really conflicted between, you know, like I completely understood that this was a TV show. This is a TV show. The Oscars is basically a TV show and it makes a lot of money and it's all about the ratings and very famous people showing their faces. And from that point of view, I could understand why they wouldn't want Jorge, but I could also understand how important it was for him to sing the song.
Ultimately, the compromise was that Antonio Banderas sang the song.
If you're comfortable with me telling this.
Please tell all the stories.
We were on the way to the Oscars, you and me in the limo with our wives and my manager. And you told me, you know, I've been to LA here and visit several producers. Yeah. And it's good that I tell it to you because you can verify. When I tell it myself, I said, this can't be true.
Yeah.
But you said it, so I'm telling it to you, and you'll be the one that will acknowledge the truth of this. You told me, I went to meet this producer that, you know, my father recommended me. And he was enraged with me because he said, so you are in that song. Of that. I don't know how he called me. How dilettante, how is he? Like an impostor.
So absolutely, outsider.
Who is this guy? Something like that. I don't know. You told me, who is this guy? Because, you know, they had the chance to nominate Mick Jagger. Remember
that? Yes, I do.
Which was the movie?
I think it was Alfie.
they made a big campaign with who else?
I think it was Dave Stewart, who's also, he was from the Eurythmics. I know it was a Mick Jagger song.
Mick Jagger song. They had made a big campaign and they couldn't get him in the nominations, which, by the way, speaks about the, you know, legality of the Oscars. You told me that story very naively.
Yes. The man said to me, who I met with, I want you to understand there is no way you're going to win. I mean, basically, he said it's an insult to us that you've been nominated.
But there's another thing that you told me, that he asked for a recount of votes. Yes, I even asked to verify the recount of votes. He was a powerful guy.
Yeah.
And do you remember that?
I don't remember that. I do not remember that.
I clearly remember that. Yeah. You didn't say. And they asked, are you sure? And they recount the votes. When you told me that, that was the inflection point. So I remember it very clearly. So I told you, wait. You say it very naively. It's an insult to the industry.
Yeah.
But I only heard that recount thing.
Yeah.
And I told you, wait a minute. If they asked for a recount and they wanted to take us out, they could have done it only easily if we were in the edge of the votes. But if they didn't take us out, we are not in the edge. We are inside. And I got this panic, this small panic attack saying, it's not impossible that we win for the first time in many months. But I never thought I was going to win until you said that. And I said, wait, so I don't have a strategy. And the day before, I gave a speech in the Latin American artist community, something like that, that they gave me a prize, a very nice one. And I made this speech bilingual, and it was a complete mess. I started by saying, I'm the son of immigrants and the grandson of immigrants. And I made a mess talking, and I moved to English. And they said, I know, oh, my God, what if I have to give a speech in the Oscars with every actor I saw in the movie sitting in the front row, you know? It looked like the wax museum.
Yeah.
So I said, I'm going to be terrified. So at that moment, I took the decision, if it happens, I'm going to just sing.
Yeah.
Because we had that controversy with the producer, with the... Gil Cates, it was his name,
yes.
I think, that didn't want me to sing. So I'm going to sing, and it's going to be nice. It's going to be, you know, a show. It's going to be a slap on the face for the production, too. But they are going to perceive it, but it's not going to be aggressive. I hate being aggressive. I don't want to get mad. I hate getting mad. I'm not good at rage. So I said, it's going to be elegant. It's going to be beautiful. I sound like Donald Trump.
I know. It's
going to
be beautiful. Beautiful.
But it's going to be, you know, it's what I know how to do. I know how to sing on a microphone. And I saw Prince and the microphones were adapted to the height. And he's short. And so I had to lean forward a little bit. So that was it. I sang my 22 seconds, I think, something like that. And all the South American community saw it as a, you know, an anti-imperialist vindication.
Clavo mi remo en el agua. Llevo tu remo en el mío. Creo que he visto una luz al otro lado del río. El día le irá pudiendo poco a poco al frío. Creo que he visto una luz al otro lado del río.
Ciao. Thank you. Gracias. Ciao.
But in a way, it's interesting. If you had been allowed to perform...
I'm happy I didn't.
It would be probably long forgotten by now, whatever we did. You know, even if we had strings and a beautiful arrangement, it would just be another performance at the Oscars. But because you had this opportunity to... make a very gentle but clear statement by singing, it became iconic.
It was a once-in-a-lifetime luck strike. So many things could have gone wrong. You know, I spoke to Gaetano Veloso many years later when I met him. And when I suggested in my interview with Gil Cates, the producer of the gala, I suggested Gaetano Veloso to sing. And he said, no, he's already been here and it was no good. Gaetano Veloso is like my biggest influence. And I saw his performance. And I think it was the worst one that I saw from him, you know.
Yeah.
He was really nervous. It's a horrible situation, which I don't want.
Wish on anyone.
Wish it to anyone. And he was really nervous. It wasn't his song. He was only an interpreter of somebody else's song. I sang many times in the Latin Grammys later. And you become crazy. It's a crazy situation. So I'm really happy I didn't have to do that at that time. And I got to sing a cappella. And it's still today remembered as some people consider it, a revolutionary gesture. Some other people consider it an elegant gesture. I'm happy with what I did.
many people saw the statement, not the fact that it won, but the way you won it when you sang the song, as a political statement of some kind, or as an anti-imperialist statement, or they could project whatever movie they wanted to onto the screen of you singing it. And it does seem like it helped to position you as an advocate for people who cross from one side of the river to the other. You kind of are a representative of all those people that cross from one side to the other. The story of the immigrant. I mean, I don't know if it influenced the work that you made afterwards. It's possible it did, but I think it influenced people to understand that you could be that person for them, that they could understand you in those terms.
I'm sure it influenced what I did, although I really tried not to guide what I did after that.
Yeah.
First of all, I don't like heroes.
Yeah.
I don't want to be one. I did everything that was in my hand to avoid being treated like a hero in Uruguay. And there was this plan to, you know, many homenages, how do you call that?
Tributes to you.
Tributes that I rejected, and I entered Uruguay in a silent way to my father's 70th birthday, and that happened in March, a few weeks after that. And I like to address things like Leonard Cohen said, that he said in his Príncipe Asturias speech, when you face adversity, and you will, do it with kindness and elegance.
And if one is to express the great inevitable defeat that awaits us all, it must be done within the strict confines of dignity and beauty.
So you can see it in the way that you want to see that gesture, but I think I was very lucky. I think I was brave enough to sing in that circumstance. My voice was trembling a little bit, but not too much. I think that was the most heroic thing I did that night, you know, to keep my diaphragm steady to sing.
Yes.
I don't know. I didn't think very much at that moment. I remember the moment. I remember it very clearly, but I don't, I didn't get to think very much, you know.
Which is good.
For me, it has a kind of a bittersweet element because the microphone was really low because it had been set for Prince, who introduced him. So Jorge had to like bend down and
sing. Did he tell you he was going to do that?
No, he didn't. But I kind of suspected it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember when, you know, when they said his name and he walked up to the stage, I was suddenly alone in that big auditorium surrounded by people that I didn't know. And Antonio came running down. He was like on the third floor or something. He came running down to give me a big hug. Mm. And I just remember feeling so grateful for that. Like, oh, thank you. Because, you know, then they, you know, they go up on stage and then they go backstage. And I didn't know what was going to happen. We weren't there with we didn't have like a manager or staff or anything. It was just us. And we didn't have a team in place in the auditorium. So I really didn't know what was going to happen.
Meanwhile, back in the rec room of our friend's house, eating their Chinese takeout and watching the show on television, he wins.
He won.
And we don't know what to do. We jump up. We do the only thing that we can think of to do, which is put on nice clothes.
Yes. Hotel gift shop dresses.
Marshall Field's
suit. And Marshall Field's pinstriped suits.
And wait for further instructions.
Yeah.
Mike Rock, who we're going to have sushi dinner with, shows up in the midst of this.
Yeah.
And we're all dressed up and we've just won. And I've got a cell phone, a 2005 era
Nokia
cell phone.
Nokia something.
And we go to sushi with him.
Right, because we don't know what else to do. And you had tried calling in the meantime, right? You probably tried texting or calling Jorge, but I think mostly you tried to reach out to his manager.
The publicist for the film, I think, is who I was into. The only number, because Jorge and Ana had Spanish numbers. I don't think they could even text at that time.
Right.
You had to go through an intermediary, and I'm texting. I'm trying to figure out, is there any way to find them? We're sitting in the sushi restaurant. I remember Mike looking at us going, what are you doing here?
Right.
Why are you here right now?
But we didn't know where to go.
Until I get a text message from the publicist who says, go to the rooftop of the Mondrian Hotel and wait.
Yeah.
You have a cold.
Yeah, I had gotten sick. I had a cold.
It's getting later now.
It's late. It's February. It's LA, but it was cold.
We're sitting on the roof of the Mondrian in this bar, kind of funky, cool bar, but there's nothing going on.
Nothing happening. And we're waiting. We had a cocktail. We had some champagne, I think.
Maybe.
We're waiting. I feel terrible. We have to do this drive the next day. It's cold. I think we were on the verge of it was like 20 more minutes and then we'll just call.
Five more minutes,
yeah.
I would say.
Yeah. And then the elevator doors open onto the rooftop
and out bursts Jorge and Ana and an entourage.
A whole entourage. Where it was a Latin party.
Yes.
It was a party for the Latin nominees. So yeah. Was it just them and their entourage, or was it even at that point, like, I forget who was in Mary Full of Grace, Katerina Sandina Moreno or something like that. And then suddenly there was just a ton of people there.
Right. And so this is where we first get to hold the Oscar, and we're celebrating it, and we're kissing, and that's where we've got these photos with them. Out of nowhere comes Tracy Morgan. I don't know why he's there.
Yes.
But I remember you're holding the Oscar.
Yeah.
And he runs up to you and he says, "Oh, girl, you got your Oscar.
Oh, girl, you got your Oscar."
And it was like, who did he think you were?
He said, "I'm some blonde, young blonde, Kirsten Dunst, whatever, anybody."
At some point then he said, and this is where the Cinderella Night aspect of it shows up. He says, I want to go to the Vanity Fair party, but I don't have an invitation.
Yeah.
And you say to him,
"You don't need one. This, and I just held his Oscar up. So this gets you into the Vanity Fair party."
So we get in the limo and we say to the Vanity Fair party, and we're going through security. You always love this story.
Yeah. Because you're waiting in line to be vetted to get into the party.
From within a limo. It's
from
a limo
within
line.
A limo. It's a line of limos. And the guy comes over to our window, and I just rolled down the window and said, "Academy Award winner Jorge Drexler." And I held up the Oscar. And they waved us through.
And you hear the guy in his walkie-talkie going,
"Academy Award winner." Yeah. Jorge Drexler.
So we do the line. We walk into the Vanity Fair party. We're a little bit late.
Vanity Fair party. It's crazy.
Right. So being dropped into that, now we are just, it's everyone. You run into Gwen Stefani in the bathroom and you drop the only name you can think of to drop, which is Shirley Manson, because you know Shirley Manson from Garbage from Madison.
Yeah.
You're in your hotel dress.
Hotel dress.
Hilary Swank, Sir Ben Kingsley.
Christina Aguilera, Kate Blanchett, Jessica Simpson, and Nick Lachey. I mean, if you've ever seen pictures of the Vanity Fair party, that's just what you can imagine. Just like every hot celebrity right now.
And we find ourselves kind of huddled. Mm-hmm. I mean, as if we were at a high school party. We're huddled in our little clique.
Yeah.
And our clique is Gael Garcia Bernal. Mm-hmm.
Penelope Cruz. Salma Hayek. Michelle Gondry.
And us.
Yeah.
And we're hanging out, whatever. I remember Jorge said he would like to meet some people, and you walked him through the room.
I did. I don't know what came over me. Oh, Sir Ben Kingsley, this is Academy Award winner Jorge Drexler. I just was doing that. It was really nuts.
My feet hurt so much, and I took my heels off, and Sir Ben Kingsley commiserated with me about my sore feet. And then we went to a party that was hosted at Prince's place, but he wasn't there.
While we were still at the Vanity Fair party, Gael Garcia Bernal says he wants to go to a different party now.
Yeah.
And he writes down an address on a piece of paper, mm-hmm. gives you his cell phone number.
Yeah,
as
somebody
backup.
Take my cell phone number. I've quickly volunteered to
and
take
he,
it.
And he writes down an address on a piece of paper. We hand that address to our limo driver, who mm-hmm. then takes us to a parking lot on Sunset Boulevard.
Mm-hmm. Where they give you another address.
That's where they give you another address. And then we spend an hour in a traffic jam.
In the Hollywood Hills.
Going somewhere. Yeah. We don't know where we're
going
to go.
Where everybody else is going in limos at the same time.
Yes. Limo traffic jam.
Yeah.
And our limo driver says, "I've only ever seen this kind of thing one time. It's a Prince party."
Right.
And it turns out I don't think it was a Prince party. It was just that we learned it was at a house where many parties are held.
Right.
But we get out of the limo finally. The thing that I remember is as we're walking in, Natalie Portman is making out with her Israeli boyfriend in the front steps of this house.
Right.
And Rick Rubin walks out of the house with Lars, the drummer from Metallica, jumping on his back. And I walked up to Rick and I was like, "My name's Leo Sidran. I produced the song that won the Oscar tonight. I was very moved by the article that I read about your relationship with Johnny Cash." And he was like, "Oh, congratulations." Yeah. We walk into the party. Leo DiCaprio walks like past us.
Adam Levine. Just banana. It was just crazy.
Right.
Just everywhere you looked. I just felt like I was standing in the corner with my jaw on the floor. And I really felt that trip, that LA is kind of a transactional town. And certainly in that scene that we were in that whole week, it's like, why am I talking to you if there's nothing you can do for me?
Right.
And we didn't have much to offer.
I remember offering the story to anyone who would listen.
Right.
We recorded this thing in my apartment, mostly in my apartment.
Yeah.
In Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
It's the first ever Spanish language song to be nominated.
Yeah.
This is way more unique than anything else that's been nominated here.
Yeah.
It didn't come through any Hollywood machinery.
Yeah.
Nonetheless. We decide, and when I spoke to Jorge the other day, he said to me at the end of the interview, "I can't believe we left that party. I can't believe we decided to leave that party. He said, somewhere in that house, Madonna and Prince were hanging out and we had to find them and we didn't find them.
Yeah.
And he said to me the other night, or the other day when I talked to him, the night you win your Oscar, you should go home like, and you don't know where your shoes are and you should be a mess, you know? And we went home too early. And I said, I don't know. I remember it being like 5 a.m. by the time we got back.
Definitely.
We went back to our friends, the Simon's house, slept for a couple hours, got in this rented, I'm going to say Nissan Altima, and drove out to Palm Springs to visit my grandparents, where they took us to the supper club, announced to the waitress.
To everybody.
And everybody, this is my grandson.
He just won an Oscar.
Like last night.
Yeah. Then we drove to the airport and got on a red eye home. We came home to Madison and I went to the office. and thankfully, my boss at the time, Mark Schmitz, came into my office and said, what are you doing? Go home. I probably looked terrible. And he sent me home.
Jorge, I will say the only part of the story that I have to disagree with is that when I told you about my meeting with the man, and I remember who he is, I could not have told it to you on the way to the ceremony because Amanda and I did not attend the ceremony. We didn't get tickets for us. So it would have been the night before or the...
Wow. Oh, we were going to another... Wow. Yeah. Yes, we went to many things.
Yes, that week we went to many events
together. But I do have a photograph of you in a limousine.
No, me too. The photo I have is of you taking the photo of me in the limousine.
Where were we going?
The night of the Oscars, we went to the Vanity Fair party, and then we went to the party in the Hollywood Hills, in that crazy party. And that's when we were in the limousine.
You have to explain that to me later, because I'm sure we had that conversation first. So maybe we had it on the phone and I mixed it up.
Or maybe we took another limousine together that week.
There were many limousines.
Yeah, I think so too.
It's a limousine rich environment. If you hadn't been there, I might have not perceived there was a chance that we could have won.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have been prepared for that. That short preparation. Did you come with us to the ceremony and stayed out, maybe in the limousine?
I know it's not true. I believe I had that with you. And if you remember it in a limousine, I'm sure I told it to you in a limousine because it is a limousine rich environment.
No. You know, memory plays tricks. But if you hadn't been there, I might have not known about that story and I might not prepared myself to sing, which was as important as the prize itself. So... thank you again.
Oh, man. Thank you. Thank you again. I mean, it is an incredible story.
I don't know if I'm going to write it down. So I'm happy we recorded it.
Me too, man. So, Anna, when it's all over, we said goodbye. I realize we said goodbye because I then drove out to the desert to see my grandfather before flying back to Madison. And I don't know what became of you. What do you remember about finishing that trip and then going back to real life after that?
Well, I remember the next day we had lunch with Walter and Dael, and then we were flown to Miami that night because the record company wanted Jorge to meet people there. We were in Miami for like half a day, and then we were flown back to Spain. And when we landed in Spain, the next day we had a press conference, which I remember was kind of weird because I remember journalists asking really sort of loaded questions and Jorge getting quite annoyed, you know, because he was not a big name in Spain until he won the Oscar. I mean, people knew who he was. Everybody in the industry knew who he was. And he was more of a name in Argentina and Uruguay. He got really big in Spain after the Oscar, but there was a slight kind of, you know, who is this Uruguayan who is sort of representing Spain in a Brazilian film? Mm-hmm. Like, do we claim him as ours or not? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
There was a moment of that. And that was very palpable that day. Yeah, I do remember that. And then he was whisked away, I think. He flew away. He went to Argentina. And I don't know, he went on this whirlwind tour after winning the Oscar. I don't remember there being like quiet days at home. I remember we went to, he had a show in Zaragoza and we went there and we took Pablo with us. And that was at the period when Pablo was very upset about having been left behind. And then I remember we went to Uruguay at Easter to spend time with his family. We went to see the president of Uruguay at the time.
How much longer were you together? Another year?
No, we broke up 4 months later. So yeah, what can I say? I mean, I think he really deserves the career that he's had, and it's something that he really, really wanted. And I'm really glad for him.
It's funny that he deserves the career that he has, and it's something that he wanted. Mm. And yet I don't think anybody could have ever predicted that this would be the thing. I mean, you can't predict an Oscar.
No, you can't. That really feels like fate, you know, like the gods, the gods fiddling around with destiny.
Well, if it was a catalyst for his career in that way, I mean, it might have been a catalyst for your relationship or the end of it also.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of like the final straw in a way, because it meant that our paths really diverged. And I couldn't find a way to accompany him on that road. Mm-hmm. I was looking in a very different direction. And, you know, I mean, looking back, I think of the many ways that, you know, my responsibility and all of that, and I regret many, many, many things. But I'm really glad I was there. Huh. I'm really glad I was there, and I'm really glad I was a part of it and that I got to see that. We were living in El Escorial at the time in the mountains outside Madrid. You know, we lived in a house, a small house with a little garden, and we didn't have anything really. And so in a way, that was kind of like, I think that part of his life is what ended there, you know, the kind of the simple, unassuming, sort of more humdrum life that kind of ended there. And I was a part of that, I think. I wasn't a part of the other, although, you know, I was an artist in my own right, but I was on a very different scale. So it wasn't very sustainable, I think.
It's, you know, looking back with the benefit of hindsight, it's easier now to see that it wouldn't have been fair for you to try to squeeze yourself into the mold of what he maybe needed. And it wouldn't have been fair for him to try to squeeze into some mold that was no longer serving him or what he needed.
Yeah. I mean, how do you negotiate that when two realities are so different? And also there's something in terms of kind of even social status, I think, that suddenly changed, you know,
Yeah.
Financial, social, all of that. It just suddenly became very, very different. It's something that I look back on often, and I think, how could it have been different? We probably weren't. I remember your mother once saying to me, "You're not a good fit."
It's such a thing my mother would say.
With her directness, I think we both needed to kind of grow up in a way.
I think it was incredibly important for me. Although I tried to minimize it at the moment. And just remember the record I did after the Oscars. Echo had been already released, and it was, in my terms, a success. I was a lousy record seller, and Echo, even before the Oscars, got some more attention. So that would have been the perfect moment to do a Latin crossover and move to LA or to Miami, and to, you know, if you have an Oscar, you, every door is going to be open, and, you know, and call Rick Rubin and say, "I want to make the next record in LA with you." And you know, and I became, like, for a short time, a Latin icon.
Yes. So,
but something happened in my life that I got divorced, as you know, some months later. The next record I made, I had to make this decision. Will I go with the impulse of the moment and move to LA and you know, do this? Or will I make a record about what's really going on inside me, which is a sad thing?
Yeah.
It's very inappropriate for this moment.
Yes.
I should write another kind of songs this moment, but I'm writing all divorce songs. Yeah. And I made this record called 12 Segundos de Oscuridad, 12 Seconds of Darkness, which is my saddest and darkest record. And I'm really proud of not following the wind of the Oscars, but having the timon.
The rudder, they call it. It's not a beautiful word in English, the rudder.
It's to say that I was the one that was guiding my life and my career.
Gira el haz de luz para que se vea desde alta mar. Yo buscaba el rumbo de regreso sin quererlo encontrar. Pie detrás de pie, iba tras el pulso de claridad.
La noche cerrada apenas se abría, se volvía a cerrar.
That was a very important moment for me. That, you know, I didn't use that moment to jump ahead. I learned that no matter what happened, I mean, nothing bigger could happen in my career. The first prize I got was the biggest one, so it ended my desire of prizes later, although I got
you,
some
you
others.
Got, you got a lot. Yeah, you got a lot.
Yes, I got. But the desire, it ended, so that was a really good thing. And I learned that I was in the songwriting world for the reasons that I love the most. I had already left a career in Uruguay in medicine, which had my economic life solved, and I took that risk, and I then took that other risk. So I'm here because I love songs, I love songwritings, and I love talking about the true feelings that I have. So yeah. I think it gave me the chance to learn what was I doing in the songwriting world. It gave me the chance to jump ahead and take a shortcut.
Yes.
Or to stay true with what you want to do. And that was a huge prize for me. Bigger than the other prizes, you know, to be proud of your intentions in this world. It gave me the possibility to be ethical with songwriting. That was a decisive point in my creative and in my personal life. I'm so happy we did it together.
You know, I've always had a tremendous love and respect for your music and you as a composer and a musician. I always felt you had a natural affinity for it. When you were a little kid, well, you know, literally 6, 7, 8 years old, I was a fan of your music, and I didn't encourage that so much as I just watched it. I always thought that the music business was a very tough business, and I didn't want to encourage you to go into it, but it was so natural for you. You just loved it. You took to it. And when you guys won that Academy Award, I felt validated. I felt like, well, I wasn't crazy, that you do have a gift, that you have a natural gift for music. And when it happened, I immediately saw this as an opportunity for you to move to a larger city. It's so unusual in the music business to be able to go to a big city and get your phone calls answered. And here it was. Here was your opportunity to do that, and you did. I think you had a couple of options. One was to go to Madrid, and the other one was to move to New York. I think Amanda was important in your deciding to go to New York and to plant your flag there. And you've been there for 20 years. It's an amazing victory to be a musician in New York for 20 years, and I was very proud of you for doing that. I thought this was the best possible outcome for you personally and professionally. You were able to do the hat trick where you found a way to get paid and also keep a sense of who you are and keep a sense of yourself. Just like Jorge, you know, the two of you managed to take this experience and not only not let it dissuade you from your natural impulse, but to follow your best self. You're making wonderful work. Jorge's at the top of his game. So there's something about this whole experience that is still deeply rooted in Jorge coming to Madrid from Uruguay and you going to Seville from Madison and crossing paths. And in a very real way, you both crossed the river.
Amanda, 2 months after the Oscars, we were living in New York.
Yeah, we did it.
I will say, I got back to Madison, and within a few days or a week or so, there was a ceremony that you helped to organize where some friends got together, bought an Oscar statue, I guess, at a trophy store, because Jorge was the one who actually won the statue.
You were also given a mayoral proclamation.
And I was given a mayoral proclamation celebrating my contributions to music and celebrating the fact that I choose to live in Madison.
And then we left.
We snapped into action. We found an apartment in Park Slope. We got our lives together. I said, I'll only come for a year.
Yeah, you wouldn't commit.
And it's 20 years that we've lived here. It's the 20th anniversary, not only of the Oscar that we were a part of, but also of us moving. I mean, it changed our lives.
Absolutely. Without question.
What do you think would have happened if that hadn't happened? What do you think would have happened to us?
Life is funny. It's hard to know. It's anybody's guess. If we had stayed in Madison, if we would have gotten here some way else, I feel like that was the only thing to get you to agree to leave. You were big fish, small pond, and that suited you just fine. And if it hadn't happened, I don't know that I would have gotten you here. Certainly not that quickly. It's hard to imagine
I have this memory, and I think it was the night that it won, of you saying to me, okay?
Yeah. Can we go now?
Can we go to New York now?
Yeah.
Honestly, for me, when I think about it, what I celebrate the most, the thing I'm most proud of, is that it was a project that really was born out of desire and love. Family relationships, friendships. There was nothing overly ambitious about it. There was no way to predict how that success could possibly happen. It just was something that almost felt inevitable. And I'm so proud that if I'm going to have a credit like that, or be a part of a project that wins the biggest award, that it was that one. I snapped into action this week because what happens with this podcast sometimes is, you know, there are some episodes that are scheduled far in advance, and then there are others where they kind of drop on me, and suddenly I go, oh my God, I got to get this thing done this week. This is so important. And they tend to be the most ambitious ones.
Yeah.
So this week I had to align all these interviews. And the hardest one, of course, is to talk to Jorge because he's so busy.
You were going to say the hardest one was to talk to me.
Actually, in a way, you're the last one. I mean, I actually got Jorge Drexler on the phone for 90 minutes.
Yeah.
And I'm down to the wire here with you. Yes, you were the last one. I think once Jorge committed to it, you're like, okay, fine.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll do it. Some of the things that are not covered in these conversations are covered on my Substack. I don't even think you know my Substack link.
I wouldn't be able to say it to the listeners right now.
I mean, you know it in your heart.
I get the email and I could click through it, but I can't tell you what the
link
is.
Well, if you want to get the email and click through it, it's leosidran.substack.com. And
that's an easy one. I'll remember that maybe.
And I'll post some photos there, and I've got some video. I actually have some video recording of us mixing Al Otro Lado del Rio at Smart Studios. And we were so young and so beautiful, I have to say. Also, third-story.com, which has always been the website. That's kind of like the deep archive of all of these conversations and interviews that I've been doing for 11 years now. There are a couple of other episodes with Jorge. I mean, I have talked to Jorge over the years. So there's in the archive a lot of backstory that kind of overlaps with this.
Yeah.
So third-story.com is the place to find the deep archive, of course, the Substack. And you can just subscribe to it wherever you listen to podcasts.
5-star reviews.
That's a really good thing to do. It's very helpful. It really is. Additionally, we are made in partnership with WBGO Studios. WBGO.org/studios is where you can learn about all of their award-winning content, including this podcast. I'm going to finish editing this podcast, and Amanda, Sidran, and the rest of you, I'll talk to you soon.
Bye, everybody.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.